late night on Air Temple Island, and Cora was on the prowl with Neri by her side. This was not an uncommon occurrence. While she had come a long way since her early days at the White Lotus compound in the South Pole, some part of her would always feel more comfortable walking alone with her thoughts, accompanied only by her faithful polar bear dog. It wasn't the healthiest of behaviors, and she well knew this, but it was a long-established habit, and she had come to terms with it. She would never feel entirely comfortable bringing certain subjects up with other people until she'd had at least a little time to process them herself. Still, she knew that she was never truly alone, not anymore. There were her friends in Republic City and on Air Temple Island, her extended family in the Southern Water Tribe, and her surrogate siblings that were the air babies and their multitude of offspring. And that wasn't even factoring her past lives as the Avatar into the equation. While she had not always appreciated their wisdom or presence, she certainly valued their existence and Brava's connection to them all. While many of the people whose lives she'd crossed had passed away, that didn't lessen the impact they had made on her own life, and she treasured each of their relationships in her own way. In diversity there is beauty. In diversity there is strength. The thought occurred to Cora as she walked through the bamboo forest to the northeast of the temple's training complex. She forgot exactly where she had read or heard it, but it resonated nicely with a phrase in a text that Griffin had lent her during one of her prior visits to New Avalon. Infinite diversity in infinite combinations. The Avatar reflected on that statement as she climbed over the rocks that defined the northern edge of the bamboo forest, followed by Neri. There was a certain undeniable truth to it, a wisdom brought from a world of logic that she had never seen, but hoped to visit someday. Nobody in Dicho would even have had an opportunity to learn about the worlds beyond Zipang, if not for the efforts of herself and others in widening the cultural bridge between the two worlds and the galaxy beyond. That was what the members of the White Lotus who had perpetrated their ill-timed deception had forgotten, or never really brought on board in the first place, that their homeworld could only benefit from increased contact and interaction with outside. That perhaps their world needed a little revolutionizing every so often to stir things up. Not change for change's sake, of course. That sort of thing rarely turned out well, consider Fire Lord Sozin. But stagnation was death, and it had been both Aang's actions and her own which helped break Dicho from the stasis that had so gripped the world's long history. And if she got outside help in doing that, and if they were good, dear friends, well, the learned masters would just have to deal with it. Cora chuckled to herself as she worked her way past the ridge and down to the scrub and brush that clung to its base. She could see the city lights now in the distance to the north and east, and the waning quarter moon that was Yue, just rising over the far peaks of the eastern horizon. She smiled at the sight and looked out towards the bay and Aang's statue beyond the cliffs below. All quiet, all well. Nothing but the deep blue of the water reflecting the moonlight and city light, the faint pink streak of hair at the cliff's edge. Wait a second. Cora halted in her tracks and squinted to get a better look. Yes, that was Utrin Atenjo sitting there, in a heartbreakingly familiar pose, at the edge of the cliff. She couldn't see Utrin's expression from this angle, but she didn't need a diagram drawn to figure out what it could be. With a murmured word to Neri, she quietly made her way to the clearing at the cliff's edge. Coming to a halt a few feet away from Utrinna, Cora was seized by a brief moment of a kind of third-person déjà vu. She shook it off, and then quietly stepped the rest of the way to the duelist's side, Neri hanging back a bit. "Utrinna?" Cora asked quietly. "Hey, what's wrong?" she asked again, resting a gentle hand on Utrinna's shoulder. As she did so, she got a good look at the prince's face as she looked out over the bay. Cora blinked. "Are you crying?" she queried, with no accusation or censure in her voice, only concern. Utina shook her head jerkily, the first acknowledgement that she had heard Cora at all. "No," she said huskily. "Maybe. I don't know. There are definitely tears happening here." She gave a helpless shrug as she gestured aimlessly toward the water. "Honestly, I've got no idea what's going on in my own head right now." "You picked a good place for it," the Avatar nodded quietly, and she settled herself down next to Utina in a similar posture. "Trust me, I've been there, sister, and you're not alone." Utina glanced over at the shorter woman as she pulled one leg up to her chest. "Yeah?" "Oh yeah," Cora confirmed, as she earth-bent a few pebbles between them, then chucked one of them into the waters of the bay. "I was a real mess back in the old days. Seriously. But I doubt you want to hear about that. If you did, there's books in Jinora's library that really go into depth about my psychological foibles. What was the early Avatar Cora thinking? Is practically an academic category in and of itself." At Utina's dubious look, Cora caught herself, coughing into her fist. "Sorry, I know what that sounded like, and that wasn't what I meant. My issues were due to upbringing and circumstance, which are a different barrel of cuttlefish." She looked at Utina in profile, studying the drying tear tracks on her cheeks. "I get the feeling your worries are a lot closer to home." Utina made a half-hearted nod. "So look," Cora went on, "just say what you want to say, however you want to say it. It won't go beyond these ears unless you wish it. Avatar's honor." "All right," Utina replied, and then her brow furrowed and she directed a curious glance at the Avatar. "What did you mean by a good place for it?" Cora smiled faintly and gestured for Neri to approach. Lying down behind them, the polar bear dog made a quiet, solid presence at their backs. Thus situated, Cora leaned back against her companion's warm side and looked out across the bay at Aang's statue. "Once, longer ago than I want to admit," she began quietly, "I came up here and sat right about where you are now, looked over at that big, crazy city that I didn't even slightly understand, and thought, 'Great spirits, I cannot do this. This is so much bigger than I can be.'" With a sigh, Cora flung another pebble into the water below. "Believing in myself had never been a problem for me before, but up to then it was mostly bravado, and that night, alone in the dark, it was all just falling down around my ears. I was a sham, a failure. I was the worst Avatar ever, and pretty soon everyone was going to know. I wanted to quit, run away, just crawl back to the South Pole with my tail between my legs and admit that everyone who said I wasn't good enough was right. I sat right there, and I knew, that whatever it was going to take to cope with my situation, it just wasn't in me." Cora took a quiet breath and let it out, briefly lost in an old memory. Utina waited a few moments before asking, "And then you found it?" The Avatar came back to herself and shook her head. "No, it found me. Or rather, they did. See, I had forgotten for a second that I wasn't alone. I had friends." Utina considered this and nodded. "They must have been really good friends. I saw the way you looked at their pictures earlier." "They were the best," Cora said with a smile. "Oh, we had our ups and downs, and weird communication problems and stupid fights and ill-advised intersections at first. We were just kids, after all, trying to navigate uncharted waters. At the same time, we were all up to our eyebrows in stuff real grown-ups would have had a hard time coping with. Of course, it was all going to go wrong sometimes. It was like ice dodging with blinders on. But at the end of the day, Asami and the bros were the best friends anybody could hope for. We could tell each other anything. Utena managed a smile, the first of that night. You just reminded me of something I said to Himemiya years ago. Koro looked puzzled. Who? Utena glanced at her, then chuckled at herself. Anthy. Himemiya is her maiden name. I got in the habit of calling her that when we were at school, before we were even really friends, much less anything else. That was the kind of school it was. She took a deep breath and continued. Anyway, when we were becoming friends, I realized that she was keeping a lot of secrets, painful ones, and I thought it was because she didn't have anyone who cared enough about her to hear them, to be there for her. I didn't think that was right. So one day I told her that I wanted to be there for her. Whatever's bothering you, bring it to me. That's the kind of friends I want us to be. Cora took that on board for a moment and smiled. I like that. That works for me. She gave Utena a gentle, playful nudge to the shoulder. So bring. Okay. Utena turned her eyes away from the avatar and gazed out to sea, falling silent as she gathered something inside herself. Then, without looking at Korra, she said as if confessing a terrible crime, I didn't want this. Utena cringed inwardly for a moment, but no reaction came from Korra except for a quiet, gentle, go on. At the avatar's non-judgmental tone, something inside Utena just broke loose. The sluice gates were open, and the words poured out. I don't know how much Corwin's written about me in his letters to you, but I've never really thought about having a child before Anthy brought it up. I didn't have any idea Anthy was even interested in having children of her own until she raised the subject last year, which shows how much I was paying attention at the time. I mean, Junichan had just come into our lives. She was enough of a kid-raising experience for me as it was, and she's more Kate's student than mine anyway. Then there was Corwin's graduation and the whole big fire invades the prom thing that happened. I assume Corwin told you about that, at least. Korra gave Utena a wordless nod and motioned for her to continue. Huh. Now that I think about it, that night might have been the point where the idea started to germinate in Himemiya's mind. All Father knows I was worried about him when the big throwdown in New Avalon happened, and I wasn't even thinking father of my potential future child like she probably was by then. Utena trailed off, then shook her head. Sorry, that just clicked for me right now. The avatar smiled slightly. No problem. Happens to the best of us. Utena managed a dry chuckle, took another breath, and continued. Anyway, I've never had any desire to bear children myself. And quite frankly, having seen it happen, I now have less than zero interest. But if Anthy wanted to go through with it, who was I to stop her? And if Corwin was okay with it, sure. It's his DNA, after all. So I went along. It's just now that it's happened. She paused, trying to regain the thread of the conversation as her confused thoughts intruded once more. Korra waited patiently as Utena regathered herself and took a different tack on it. I mean, look, a lot of my life has been stepping up to the plate, even if I have no idea what the batting order is, and giving it my best, swinging for the horizon. Kate and the Duelists, Dad and the IPO, full steam ahead, doing the best I could, no matter how much I stumbled along the way. Thanks to them, I think I've done a lot of good in the world. And even if my life path isn't anything you'll hear about in a college career center, it's been pretty satisfying. The thing is, parenting definitely didn't factor into it. At least, not for a good long while. Building a family with Himemia and Corwin, sure, I didn't have a problem with that. I proposed to both of them in the first place. At Cora's curious eyebrow, Utrina coughed and blushed slightly. Well, not at the same time. It was 3 years apart, give or take. There was a long time there where Corwin and I sort of held ourselves back, until Anthy finally got fed up with it, sat us down, and told us we didn't have to. Cora made a wordless ah and nodded. Please don't think I'm hating on them, on us, having had a child, Utrina said, her scattered mind scampering back to the previous thread. I mean, Annabelle's wonderful. She really is. She's amazing. And I'm glad that she's here with us now. You've seen how everybody's taken with her, and the joy on Corwin and Anthy's faces when they look at her. She shook her head. It's a marvel. The only time I've seen them come close to that were the days when we got married. I'm not envious, and I know they're still a part of my life, and always will be, but... Utrina trailed off, then went on in a quieter voice. But that's Corwin's daughter there. And they look so natural together. So right. And however much they say I am, however much they want me to be, on some fundamental level, I'm not really part of that. That's just biology. We can't change it. She squeezed her eyes tightly shut, and another tear trickled down her cheek. Cora reached over and rested a gentle hand on Utrina's shoulder, patiently waiting for her to continue at her own pace. After several sniffles, Utrina brushed the tear streak away and looked down at her hands with a mixed expression. I didn't want this, she gestured with her right hand. But I didn't not want it either, she added with her left hand. I don't think Corwin could even work out the logic for that. I'm not sure even Aunt Belle could. With a cry, Utrina threw up her hands and looked up at the night sky. Ah, this is confusing enough already. With an angry sound, she snatched up one of the pebbles that Cora had earthbent and flung it out into the bay. The Avatar didn't have any time to appreciate the Rose Prince's throwing arm, though. For just then, Utrina turned where she sat, facing Cora fully for the first time that night. Her eyes were intense, her face serious, as she sat up straighter, no longer slouching toward the cliff edge, but leaning towards Cora as she gesticulated. There's something you've got to understand, Cora. Himemia spent years being denied any agency whatsoever, partly by herself, but only partly. The situation she was in, I can't even describe it properly right now, at least not with a level head. One of the main things Corwin and I fought for was to give her control of her life, restore her sense of her own identity, her value as an individual. Back when I was in school at Otori, and when Corwin came to Sephiro for his trial, and always, always afterwards, we did everything we could to enable the opportunities she didn't have when she was in her birdcage, and she loved them, and we loved her having them. When she came back to Midgard with me, she fit in with the rest of us like she was always meant to be there. Cora nodded, unperturbed by Utrina's intensified, rather disjointed, explanation. So, Utrina went on, when she came to me and said she wanted a child, I mean, what was I going to do? Tell her no? You can't do that? after we fought the whole damn world so that none of us would ever have to hear that again? She threw up her hands again and slumped backward against Neri's side. The polar bear dog accepted the treatment without complaint as Utrina crossed her arms. I was kind of trapped by my own principles. Corwin and I moved heaven and earth to win her freedom. Naturally, that included the freedom to have aspirations I didn't share. If it didn't, that would mean I was a liar. She turned her head to look directly at Cora. I'm not a liar. Cora met Utrina's blue-eyed gaze with her own. I know you're not, Utrina, she said with such direct earnestness that it calmed the Rose Prince somewhat. Utrina relaxed slightly as she returned her focus to the sea, sky, and statue beyond, and gained a newfound appreciation for the warmth of a polar bear dog's sides. She let out a long sigh and stretched her arms back against Neri's fur before lowering them again. It's just I'm not sure what I'm feeling, Utrina admitted quietly. And Emily's words didn't help any. Sometimes crazy works. I quipped it at the time, but are we crazy for having done all this? What's wrong with me for thinking this in the first place? Why couldn't I tell Himimia and Corwin about it? She looked up at the fully risen quarter moon, the moonlight reflected in her eyes. Our entire relationship is based on being able to tell each other anything. Me and Anthy, me and Corwin, Corwin and Anthy, all three of us together. We're the Trinity, for Pete's sake. She shook her head. I just feel like I'm letting them down, twice. With that, Utrina let out another long sigh, her energy spent. She and Cora sat there in silence for several drawn-out moments, the only sounds between them that of Neri's heavy breathing and the surf below. Heavy stuff, Cora finally said once she judged enough time had passed. I admit it's a bit of a puzzle, but I'll give it my best shot. She stretched her arms back, much like Utrina had earlier, then relaxed and looked over at the pink-haired duelist. Okay, first off, I assume you've already internalized the whole a person's body is her own, nobody else has the right to dictate what happens to it thing, right? A nod from Utrina, and Cora continued, good, good. Well then, take Azana, for instance. Utrina raised an eyebrow. What about her? Well, she's a career woman like you, one of our best and brightest, and I doubt she'll be playing pro-bending forever. Not that I think she'd fail if she went for the long haul, but she's got the knowledge and the skills to really make a career out of teaching if she wanted. And if not, there's always other places that could make use of her talents to protect others. Despite what her mom might want, at this, Cora rolled her eyes, Azana doesn't see herself ever bearing a child either. She's comfortable with that, happy about it even, and that's perfectly fine by me. How do you know about this? Utrina wondered. After game beers with the Fire Ferrets after the championship last year, Juan and I were the most sober people in the room, and that's not saying much. Cora picked up a pebble and tossed it into the bay before continuing. So, not seeing yourself raising a child, however you do it, at this point of your life, perfectly understandable. Child-free is a completely legitimate life choice. Utrina nodded slowly. All right, but that's not really my problem. I don't feel pressured to, join the club myself. I just, where do I fit? How do I react? Knowing my own choice is legitimate doesn't help me address any of that, she pointed out. Cora considered this fact for a moment. True. Well, there's always sparring. Wait, what? Utna asked, briefly derailed. Get the blood flowing, all the negative energy out and spent. I'm sure you and Kate have gone a few rounds to settle matters or clear the air before, right? Well, yeah, but that wasn't involving stuff between me, Anthea, and Corwin. Also, would that even be fair? I mean, you're the Avatar, and I'm, well, me. Well, sure, if we set a few ground rules, Korra said with a grin. No bending, no blades, no magic, no Avatar state. Just you, me, the ground, and the bay beyond. Well, thanks for the offer, Korra, but I'm not sure that'd help, Utna admitted. Besides, I've never really learned how to fight empty-handed. Really? The Avatar replied with raised eyebrows. I thought that was standard training for IPO agents. She shook her head, quietly amused. First Anne, now you. Man, do I need to tutor everybody here? Oh well, another time then. The two of them looked out toward Aang's statue in silence for a while, until Korra spoke again. Anyway, to address what Emily said, I don't think you're crazy. But you've got to be willing to take time for yourself. Because believe me, buying too much into your assumed self-perception as the Rose Prince, or the Trinity, or the Avatar, can get painful. She closed her eyes briefly in an old memory, before opening them again to look at Utna. You're all connected, and that's wonderful. I've rarely seen anything like it. But you're all human, too. And being human means you're going to stumble sometimes. There's going to be doubts, things you fear you can't tell anybody else, for whatever reason. But that's okay. And you don't have to worry about negative reactions from Corwin or Anthy, whether you bring it up or not. If you tell them about it, or don't tell them about it, they won't turn you away or censure you. That's not the people you and I and Kate and all the rest know. It's not the Anthy Janora's grown so fond of. And it's for damn sure not the Corwin I've known all his life. Seeing the slight fierceness in Korra's eyes as she said the last part, Utna couldn't help but smile a little, even under the circumstances. I like how sure you are of that, she said. You know, it occurs to me that you basically knew him for all the time I didn't, and vice versa. Between us, we more or less cover his whole life, apart from a few months. She trailed off, looking thoughtful, then said, I never thought about it before, but there must be a big adjustment happening lately for you, too. Those were pretty important years. Korra chuckled. Yeah, not so big, she said easily, then admitted, I was a little worried that it might be. I mean, I had his letters, but still. Before I left for Sephiro, I tried to prepare myself, in case the boy I knew so well had grown up to be a man I didn't recognize. Maybe even didn't particularly like. She shook her head with the same sentimental smile Utna had seen during their conversation with Emily, when the reporter had asked Korra what she was to Corwin. But he hadn't. I mean, yeah, obviously in some respects he's very different from the last time I saw him. But in all the ways that matter, he's exactly the same as he always was. And Corwin will always be Corwin, even on Judgment Day, Utna quoted. Korra nodded, recognizing the line. Yeah, exactly. So no worries there. Heck, he's better than before. All that realized potential. Remember the photo I showed you earlier of my original crew? Grown-up Corwin is like somebody made the greatest hits album. Bolin's effortless charm and his huge heart. Mako's bravery and dedication to his work. Asami's amazing brain and her spirit of adventure. Having him around is... She grinned. Not hard work. Utina surprised herself slightly by coming up with a genuine giggle for that. That's good. I'll have to remember that. Anyway, said Cora, the point is you know these people better than anybody. Maybe better than you know yourself. So if you stop and take a deep breath, you'll know. They're not going to push you away or come down on you for having normal human feelings about such a huge change in your life. I mean, you tell me. Does that sound like your family, judging without cause? Utina blinked. No, of course not. Well, there you go, then, Cora said with a smile as she leaned back against Neri again. I think it'll work out, and I think you'll do fine. The Rose Prince brought that on board with a, huh, and then chuckled a bit. I think you've got a point there, Cora. I generally try to, the Avatar grinned, and gently bumped her hand against Utina's at her side. Funny thing about families, Utina. They may start with blood, but they don't end there. Heck, sometimes they don't even start there. Karana and Izana are family by their own choice. Have been ever since they were 12. And Aang, Katara, Sokka, and the rest of the gang, they were family long before Aang and Katara got married. You know, that sounds familiar, Utina mused with a smile. I know, right? Korra agreed. So yeah, Annabelle may be genetically Corwin and Anthy's kid, but family-wise, she's just as much yours, too. So, what do we do now? Utina asked after mulling it over. Well, our doors are always open here, you know, the Avatar offered. Even if you don't technically have a place in Republic City yet, Jinora and the rest would be more than willing to host you for as long as you need. Give you a little more breathing time away from the rest of the outside galaxy, to get some more breathing room to find a new balance. I don't know. I wouldn't want to impose, but it is tempting, Utina admitted. I'd have to discuss it with them. Well, there you go, Cora proclaimed with a playful tap on the shoulder. Heck, stay long enough, I could even take the three of you ice dodging. I kinda was planning to take Corwin all those years ago, but then you happened, and, well... She gave Utina a sheepish grin. Sorry about that, Utina replied with one of her own, her hand behind her head. Believe me, it wasn't planned. She then paused, as something from earlier linked up with what Cora had just said. Wait a second, what's ice dodging? You mentioned it before. Cora answered with a smile. It's a water tribe rite of passage, one of several that we have. You basically have to show that you can command others in treacherous water conditions. It's a big way to demonstrate mutual trust. When people outside the tribe do it, they'll often be made honorary members. That's how Aang got formally recognized as part of the Southern Water Tribe, for one. Wait, so that means... Utina said, eyes widening. Cora nodded. I intended long ago to make Corwin part of the tribe, my tribe, and I would be more than pleased to extend the same invitation to you and Anthy. Wow. We'd be honored. Sounds like a plan, then. Cora grinned and held up a fist to Utina. Grinning, Utina held up a fist of her own and bumped it against Cora's. I'm proud to be a part of it. With all that worked out, Utina at last began showing signs that her mind was spinning down enough that she could rest. Falling silent, she leaned against Cora's shoulder for a while. Eventually, her head nodding, she began drifting gently into sleep, sliding slowly to one side and down as her body relaxed. Cora sat looking out to sea, a thoughtful look on her face, while Uchina semi-consciously made herself more comfortable alongside her. She probably ought to have packed the younger woman off to bed, but it would have broken the moment somehow. And besides, after all they had just challenged together, she was content to let her be. The Avatar sat for a minute or so, reflecting on all that had just passed, while the surf washed against the rocks far below, and Republic City gleamed in the distance. As she did, the sights and sounds and scents of her surroundings called a bit of a favorite big universe poem to her mind. The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends. 'Tis not too late to seek a newer world. Without really thinking about it, she began to sing, the well-worn words of a lullaby in her native tongue rolling softly and sweetly from her lips. This day is over now. Tomorrow soon will come. So rest, my child, and dream, and know that you are loved. The hunters will return soon, the fishers with their catch. The spirits dance above our land, to light them to their homes. This day is over now. Tomorrow soon will come. So rest, my child, and dream, and know that you are loved. Yue smiles upon us, child. Tui and La swim ever on. And you and I are warm and dry, and safe from every harm. This day is over now. Tomorrow soon will come. So rest, my child, and dream, and know that you are loved. By the time she finished, Uchina was fast asleep, her head pillowed on Korra's thigh, one fist drawn loosely up under her chin. Looking down at her sleeping face, Korra found that she was one of those people who sleep like children, all their cares erased from their faces in repose. She smiled at the sight. Man, haven't sung like that in a while. I missed it, Korra mused, mostly to herself, as she looked up at the quarter moon. You've always had a beautiful voice, Korra, replied the moon, the Avatar's dear friend, her face reflected in her own light. And it looks like it was just what your young friend needed. Heh, thanks. And hey, Yue, thanks for the light tonight. It really helped the mood. It was my honor and pleasure, Korra, said the moon spirit. I look forward to seeing more of your new friends in the future. I'm certain there'll be plenty of times for that, Yue. Korra yawned deeply, relaxed further back on Neri's side, resting a hand on the sleeping Uchina's shoulder. And that's it for me, I think. Unukut, Angiyuga Yue. Unukut, Nukara Korra, replied the moon spirit with a fond smile, before withdrawing fully to her celestial abode. Korra waved with her free hand as she departed, then gently rested it on the side of Uchina's head, and very slowly, carefully straightened her legs, so that she could fully relax, without disturbing the younger woman. As she drifted off to sleep herself, running her hand through Uchina's hair, she gave the duelist one last look, and smiled softly as she murmured, Unukut, Paniga Uchina. Friday, March 19th. Uchina returned to Tenzin's house not long after dawn, feeling surprisingly good considering she'd slept on the ground. In the opening light of what looked like being a gorgeous day, the shadows, outer and inner, of the previous night seemed as though they belonged to a time much longer ago. Roused by the sunrise, she and Korra had parted without exchanging a word beyond morning greetings. In one moment the two women had shared, smiling silently at each other, hands still clasped, where one had pulled the other to her feet. They felt as though they had known each other for years, not a week. And having known each other for years, they had no need of conversation on an occasion such as this. The smiles and the hands said whatever needed saying. She entered the house quietly, assuming the others would still be asleep, and indeed she was 75% correct. Entering the bedroom, she found Corwin sprawled on one side of the bed, one of his hands outstretched and resting on the edge of Annabelle's cradle, while their daughter and her dragon slept within, Garnet coiled protectively around Annabelle's body. The only evidence of Anthy, though, was the mussed covers on the empty side of the bed. Utna kicked off her shoes and went into the bathroom, unbuttoning her wool shirt as she went. Anthy was in the bathtub, sunk down to her shoulders in suds. She looked up as Utna entered, an expression of relieved concern on her face. "We missed you last night, darling," she said without aggression. "Yeah, sorry about that," said Utna. She shrugged out of the shirt, balled it up, and put it in the corner hamper, then went and sat on the wide combing around the capacious tub, peeling off first one sock, then the other. "I went for a walk. Had a lot of stuff on my mind." She looked up, meeting Anthy's eyes, and smiled. "I think I'm okay now. I'm sorry if I worried you." Then, looking around the room, for what, she wasn't sure, she said, "Come to think of it, I'm a little surprised you didn't come looking for me. Or, well, that Corwin didn't, or at least lends me." "I asked him if he thought we should," Anthy said. "He just shook his head and said we ought to leave you be. That if you were in any difficulty we could help with, you would call for us." Utina's cheeks colored. She glanced away, abashed. "Damn," she said softly. "I didn't think I was that obvious." "You wouldn't have been," Anthy said gently, "to anyone who didn't know you so well or love you so much." Utna hung her head. "I'm sorry," she repeated. "I didn't want to worry you." "It's all right, my love," Anthy insisted. "We're all going to have moments when we need to step back and gather ourselves. I hope you don't think I have ever assumed that no adjustment would be required on your part, or that it would be easy for you to make." Utna looked up at her, then gave a wan smile. "Thank you." She really did feel better about the things that had been bothering her the night before. Now she was just working on the revelation that she hadn't been as discreet about them as she thought. Recovering something of the equanimity she'd come in with, she chuckled wryly and quipped, "You give birth and I get postpartum depression. That seems fair." Thus restored, she rose and said with a grin, "I don't suppose I can interest you in switching to the shower?" "Plenty of room in here," Anthy remarked, indicating the size of the bathtub. "I've kind of gone off tubs at the moment," Utna replied. She reached into the shower cubicle, turned it on, and left it for the hot water to start coming while she took off the rest of her clothes. Then, turning, she saw that Anthy had pulled the drain cock and risen from the tub while her back was turned. "What?" Utna blinked, resisting an urge to ostentatiously rub her eyes. "You... where's?" She looked suspiciously around the room again. "Is this real? Did I dream the last year?" Smiling just a little wickedly at her confusion, Anthy stepped out of the tub and walked over to her, right up to her, draping her arms around Utrina's neck and pressing herself as close as if they had been slow dancing. Slender and athletic, honed by the duelist training regimen she'd adopted not long after their wedding, Anthea's body fitted almost perfectly to Utrinus when she stood on tiptoes. This had not been the case for some time now, and, Utrina had been given to understand, should not reasonably have been expected again so soon. Forehead to forehead, so close Utrina could feel her lips moving as she spoke, Anthy murmured in a low, amused purr. "I'm a witch, darling." With that, she kissed her dumbfounded husband thoroughly, then guided her into the shower and closed the glass door behind them. As if to make up for her disappearing act the night before, Utrina took her first turn at minding Annabelle alone, apart from Garnet, so that Anthy could go with Corwin to breakfast. She regretted missing the stir Anthy would cause, turning up looking as though nothing much out of the ordinary had happened to her at any time in the past year, but on the other hand, she'd seen it first, and, as it were, in the greatest detail. Besides, she'd gotten to see Corwin's reaction when, at length, they emerged from the bathroom and found him sitting on the edge of the bed, smilingly contemplating his sleeping daughter. Glancing up, he'd performed a double take for the ages, the thought of which could still make Utrina giggle 20 minutes later. As they were preparing to leave, Corwin drew Utrina aside and asked quietly, "Are you okay, Elskar?" "Yeah," she replied, nodding. Honestly, she added, "I wasn't, but I am now." Smiling, she added, "Thanks to your imaginary friend." Corwin gave her a thoughtful smile, but didn't press for details. Instead, he kissed her gently, said he was glad, and then he and Anthy went to breakfast. In the dining hall, just as Utrina had predicted it would, Anthy's transformation stopped the breakfast conversation dead upon her entrance. None of the clothes she had brought with her fit any longer, of course, so she was wearing Utrina's, a pair of her cargo shorts and a fire ferret's t-shirt, which made the change doubly impossible to miss. Everyone, from the young air nomads to the aged masters, stopped talking and eating to gaze at her in dumbfounded silence. Silence which, after a second or two, was broken by Master Ikki declaring flatly, "That is cheating." Then, grinning broadly, she applauded, as did several of her fellows. With a slightly blushing, self-deprecating smile and wave, Anthy went to take a seat at Cora's table. "How did you do that?" Rory wondered. Not incredulously, but in a tone of simple curiosity. "Magic," Anthy replied cheerfully. "Ah," he said matter-of-factly, "that'd do it." And he returned to work on his pancakes without another word. "That's a spell every woman should know," Amy quipped dryly. "Just in case." "As far as I know, oh, thank you," said Anthy as an air acolyte brought her a tray of food. "As far as I know, my mother's people invented it," Anthy said, then smiled a touch darkly and added, "Most magical researchers probably don't know about it because they're looking in the wrong grimoires. Its name hasn't anything to do with pregnancy or childbirth. It's called the Assassin's Last Surprise." Amy tilted her head curiously, then smiled a little cruelly herself as the scenario unpacked in her imagination. "Ah," she said. "Clever." "Good grief, where did your mother come from? Renaissance Florence?" Rory wondered. "Svartalfheim," Anthy replied blithely. "Almost as bad. Amy, would you pass the lychee jam, please?" After breakfast, Anthy went off to the Air Temple, deep in consultation with Jinora. Corwin didn't mind being abandoned. He had business of his own to attend to anyway. He found Lakpa alone on the pavilion at the southwest corner of the island, meditating with her back to the morning sun. A westerly sea breeze was blowing across the island, wafting her waves of dark hair gently behind her, her profile perfectly composed and serene, but at the moment Corwin was unusually indifferent to the aesthetic value of his surroundings. He mounted the steps to the pavilion, stopped a few yards away from her, and spoke her name. She ignored him for a few moments, perhaps finishing a sutra internally. Then she opened her eyes, turned her head, and regarded him quizzically. "What?" she asked. "Don't play the innocent," Corwin replied. "You know very well what." Lakpa rolled her eyes. "Oh, is this about Nima? Sorry, was she very awful?" She rose to her feet and inquired casually, "Did she get clingy? Spirits, she didn't try to kiss you, did she? Ugh." "What she did or didn't do is none of your damn business," Corwin snapped. "Much like her feelings. How dare you?" He shook his head, his face part angry, part sad. "I've watched you take your little shots at her for years, but there was a line I never saw you cross before last night. That was cruel, Lakpa. There's no other word for it, and there's no excuse for it." "Oh, you think so, do you?" Lakpa shot back. "Well, you haven't had to live with her. My sister the prodigy, great-grandma's favorite, the great scholar. Breezing through all her trials and getting her arrow at 16, and all the time dragging around her big, fat crush on you that was only a secret from the old people." She folded her arms across her chest and gave him a scornful look. "Earthly detachment, my ass." Corwin scowled at her. "So you figured you'd throw it in her face in the most embarrassing way you could think of? That's real mature. And don't even get me started about your detachment," he added pointedly. "I am not a master airbender," Lakpa said. "I don't even aspire to be a master airbender. Besides, our parents, their parents, their parents," she added with a sweeping gesture. "How detached were they?" "Not very, obviously. We're here now." She folded her arms again and gave a derisive snort. "That whole thing is a scam designed to keep us in line. Any time we take a fancy the elders don't approve of, they can trot out the detachment sermon. Well, I'm not buying it anymore. It's not my fault if Nima still is, and she's crap at it. It's actually kind of refreshing that there is something she's crap at in the first place," she added with a faintly malicious little smile. Corwin just stood looking back at her for a few seconds, not trusting himself to speak. Lakpa took his silence for conceding the point and sat back down, facing away, to resume her meditation. "So, hey," she said over her shoulder, "I'm sorry I put you on the spot, but if you're looking to give me guilt about poor little Nima and her feelings, forget it." At that point, Corwin became aware that he had two, and only two, options. Go over there, haul her back to her feet, and slap her across the face, or walk away. He walked away. "It's just as well Nal doesn't seem to be around just now," he thought as he walked back to Tenzin's house. "If he had been, he'd probably have felt obligated to take her side, and at that point, I don't even know what. This just won't do." "So what do you kids do for fun around here?" Rory inquired of Sita as he, the young air acolyte, and Amy sat by the Bagua circle and watched Master Milo put a group of other youngsters through their paces. "Yeah, really. It can't just be train, train, train all the time," Amy agreed. "It feels like it sometimes," Sita replied. "The airbenders have their training, and we acolytes do most of the physical forms, too. And then there's all the maintenance and housekeeping. Between that and our studies, the days are pretty full." "Oh, come on," said Amy, elbowing the girl gently. "You must have some time for games. You'd all go mental otherwise. Well, I mean, there's Pai Sho and that other game from Zupang, said Sita, uncomfortably aware that the visitors probably didn't mean sit-down-and-think type games. On the circle, Milo dismissed the students, who scattered almost at once. One of them, young Tenzin, crossed to where they sat. What's up? He wondered. Amy was just asking if you guys ever have time for games, said Rory. Sure, Tenzin replied, nodding. Milo just gave us the rest of the morning off, as a matter of fact. You should spend that time working on your reading, said Sita primly. She's probably right, said Amy. Then, with a slightly wicked little smile that raised a blush in the boy's cheeks, she asked him, So what are you going to do instead? Do you have any sports on the island? Rory wondered. Well, we don't have room for a baseball diamond, said Tenzin. We have to go to town and use one of the ones in the park if we want to play that, and that's a whole afternoon. But there's airball. Amy grinned. Aha, now you're talking. She rose, brushing imaginary dust from the knees of her black tights. What do you say the four of us play a little two-a-side? Shirts v. skins. Sorry, lads, your skins, she added with a wink, making Tenzin blush again. Sita blinked. Tenzin's the only one of us who's an airbender, she said. That wouldn't be fair in any way. Said Amy dismissively. We can take 'em. With a conspiratorial, eye-rolling smile for her newly declared teammate, she added, They're only boys. Corwin's lingering dissatisfaction began to dispel when he reached the house. From the front steps, he could see that the expedition was almost ready to depart over in the courtyard. Under Iki's cheerful supervision, the Air Acolyte ground crew was saddling up two Sky Bison, Mogi and Rohan's mount, Peavy. At the speed with which they usually worked, they'd be finished in minutes. Corwin smiled, his good humor mostly restored, and went inside. In the front room, he found Anthy just completing preparations as well, putting the finishing touches on getting Annabelle neatly swaddled. To his surprise, she... Anthy, not Annabelle, was dressed very like an air acolyte, in a robe-over-dress combo not unlike her anniversary outfit from Ming's, but all in shades of red. Where'd you get this? He wondered, brushing the crimson outer robe with his fingertips. Jinora was kind enough to let me borrow a few things, until I have a chance to get home and unpack my old wardrobe again, she replied, smiling. She says I've done enough reading over the last few days that she practically thinks of me as a novice acolyte anyway. Corwin chuckled. Well, the look does suit you, he said. Then, crooking an eyebrow, he said as if he'd just noticed it. No sash, though? It's there, said Anthy, indicating a neatly folded bundle of scarlet cloth lying next to Annabelle. One of its many uses is as a wrap for carrying babies. Would you care to try it out? I thought you might carry her on the flight out, and perhaps Utrina would like to give it a try on the way back. Sure, said Corwin. If you don't think... Wonderful, said Anthy, beaming. You just get that sorted, then, and I'll go and pack some things we'll probably need once we get there. Addressing Annabelle, she declared, It's all very exciting, isn't it? Said Corwin, but she had breezed off to the bedroom to collect the required items by that point and left him to his work. Utrina emerged from the same room a minute or two later, togged out in one of her jacket and tie rigs, having felt the occasion called for a dressier touch, to find Corwin, well, she wasn't really sure what he was doing. While Garnet watched with an air of deep bemusement from the sideboard, he and Annabelle appeared to be in the process of losing an argument with several yards of red silk. Well, that can't be right, because now I can't see. Corwin muttered, unwinding a coil of fabric he apparently had expected to settle somewhere other than around the top of his head. Hang on. No. What are you doing? Uchna wondered, unable to keep from giggling at the look of comical bemusement on his face. This is evidently supposed to be configurable as some kind of baby-carrying device, Corwin said, momentarily losing one of his hands into an unexpected fold. I can only assume, he added, turning completely around, that it's intended to be set up by someone with four arms. Maybe Avatar Yangchen invented it. I see, said Uchna, folding her arms with a smile and watching him work. This is just a piece of cloth, Corwin remarked a fruitless minute or so later, sounding slightly desperate. Yes, Uchna agreed. It doesn't have any buckles, it doesn't have moving parts of any kind, Corwin went on. No, Uchna agreed. It can't be this hard. Corwin winced a little as Annabelle, slightly caught in a twist of silk, made a mild noise of protest. Sorry. Uchna, unable to help herself, started giggling again. Yes, yes it can, she observed. Corwin Mock glared at her. Stop laughing and come help untie me before I drop her. Uchna complied, still giggling. How did you get into this predicament in the first place? Anthy asked if I wanted to carry her on the flight out. I don't know, it seemed simple. Maybe you should try it. Oh no, not without expert help I don't, Uchna said, unwinding the cloth from around his middle. If the Norse god of Mecca can't make this work without help, I'm not dumb enough to try it by myself. This isn't Mecca, this is a textile, Corwin protested. Well outside my field, although I will build a baby-carrying robot if I have to. He tugged his free arm out of a loop. I swear they must airbend this on. We don't, as a general rule, said Janora from the door. But it does help sometimes. Would you like assistance? Corwin rolled his eyes at the once again giggling Uchna, who said, Yes, please. I believe we will stop and ask for directions now.